Hi, my name is Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
And my sobriety date is September 23rd of 2002. And I am from the Smith Mountain Lake and Manita groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a sponsor, and I am a sponsor. And I'm grateful to be here. Thank you, Sam, for asking me to come. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I haven't told my story in a little while, and I haven't thought about what I'm going to say tonight because I find it's usually better if I don't think about it, and I just ask God to speak through me, and we'll see what happens. So if it's horrible, you can, you know, maybe blame God or something. I'm not sure. I don't know how that's going to work out for you either, but... So I grew up in kind of a rural area outside of Baltimore, Maryland. I have an older sister who's actually here with me this evening. I don't know what that says about our family that we're both here, but and a father and a mother, and we were a middle-class family, pretty normal. We definitely had our dysfunctions and our craziness, but I think most families do. Growing up, you know, I was given every opportunity to succeed at life. You name an extracurricular activity, I was part of it. I mean, anything from ballet, tap, jazz, piano, violin, saxophone, clarinet, Girl Scouts, jump rope team, theater group. I even did a short stint in Job's Daughters. I played soccer. I played softball. I was a cheerleader. I did beauty pageants. You know, like seriously, every opportunity to succeed at life I was given. But for some reason, I just never felt right from the beginning, you know, and that's not what makes me an alcoholic. It's just my experience that I have to share with you tonight. I just always felt this feeling of being less than or that something was missing. I lived in a lot of fear growing up, and I couldn't have told you that in the moment, but in retrospect, looking back, you know, I was always scared of something. I was scared someone was going to break into our house in the middle of the night. I was scared of that people didn't like me or scared of what you thought of me. I was always thinking about what other people thought of me or whatever, you know, that just massive self-centeredness. And I guess to some extent that's probably normal for children, right, to be a little self-centered, but I'm pretty sure I took it to an extreme. And for me, what happened was when I was 9 years old, my parents separated, and I stayed with my mom. And I chose to stay with my mom because at 9 years old, I was old enough to know that if I stayed with mom, I was going to be able to do whatever I wanted. And so that's what I did. And over the next few years, alcohol was introduced to my life, you know. And I can't tell you the first time I had like a sip of alcohol or a drink. I remember being in middle school at a friend's house or something, or at my mom's boyfriend's house with the kids in the neighborhood, and I'd have like a Zima or a wine cooler or whatever. And I don't remember ever feeling like an effect of that, you know, of that one drink. But for me, I remember my first drunk perfectly. You know, I was in eighth grade. It was New Year's Eve, and it was just me and my girlfriend at the house. And we each had 2 4-packs of Jack Daniel's down home punches. And they were good, weren't they? And she brought over her older brother's drinking game. Like, so we would take shots of these wine coolers. But after a couple of shots, I intuitively knew this was not the way we needed to drink these things. So I just went ahead and downed all of mine and half of hers. So if you're doing the math, I think 3 times 4 is 12. So I had 12 wine coolers. And I'm pretty little now. I was pretty little then at 13 years old. And I felt fantastic. I mean, I just remember for the first time in my life feeling like I could breathe easy. I felt comfortable in my skin. I don't know if I thought about what other people were thinking of me, but if I did, I can tell you this much. I did not care. I did not care. I felt so free, and it was such like a problem-free night. I mean, we ran around the house and danced and sang and, you know, my friend passed out, so when her boyfriend called, I talked to him all night, you know, and the room started spinning, then I vomited, and then everything was well again, you know, and that was it. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful evening, because for me, it was the first time in my life I had experienced that freedom from the bondage of self. You know, it was the first time in my life that spring inside me had loosened up. It was the first time that I wasn't riddled with that anxiety that went on inside my head 24/7. And it just was a beautiful, beautiful relief. And I don't remember making any kind of like resolution, like, I'm going to drink every chance I get. I hear people share that. I don't remember saying that or thinking that. But I know for me that my drinking progressed very, very, very quickly. By the time I started my freshman year in high school, and I had moved. My mom and I and my sister had moved to a new school district. So I was starting at a new high school where I didn't really know many people. And I do remember making a decision that this was going to be different. I made a decision that I was going to seek out the people who wanted to have a good time like I wanted to have a good time. And that's what I did. And so by the time I started my freshman year at high school, I dropped out of every extracurricular activity that I was in. Because you know what? Didn't matter how many soccer goals I got, it didn't give me the same feeling that alcohol gave me. You know, it didn't matter how many A's I brought home on my report card. That didn't fill me up the way that alcohol filled me up. And by the time, I mean, I'll kind of fast forward. By the time I was 16, I was a daily drinker and I was a heavy drug user. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but drugs are a huge part of my story because they were a lot easier for me to get than alcohol at 16 years old. But I will say, you know, my mom was a great enabler, and she would go to the liquor store for me frequently because she just didn't want to deal with me, you know. And that's the kind of person I had become, you know. I had gone from this straight-A student who was a real people pleaser and a real approval seeker to someone who would terrorize her mom so badly that she would just give in and go to the liquor store because it was easier than having to deal with me. You know, that's the type of person that I had become. And I was raised with morals. I was brought up going to church and all those things, but like I said, by the time I was 16, daily drinker, heavy drug user, I was a thief, a liar, and a cheat. You know, all of those morals had gone out the window. You know, and I remember growing up thinking, daydreaming about, like, what I'd be as an adult. You know, like, oh, I'm going to be, like, a strong, independent woman. I'm going to be a businesswoman, and I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to live on my own. And, you know, by the time I was 14, I was like, I can have a trailer somewhere. Maybe I'll be a stripper, and life will be good, you know, like, I'll be taken care of. And that was, like, my aspirations at that point, you know, like how quickly alcoholism had lowered my standards for myself. And it didn't even have to be my trailer, you know. Like, it could be your trailer. It's fine. As long as there was alcohol there, we were happy. And so, I mean, I can just tell you in a general way, the first time I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 16 years old, and I just had my first drunk driving accident. I had hit black ice in my rear-wheel drive Camaro. And I hit ice and I started skidding, you know, and I had had my license 9 days. I didn't know you weren't supposed to turn out of the skid, you know. So I turned out of the skid, and then we spun out, and then we flipped end over end and landed upside down in a drainage ditch. And I was the only one wearing my seatbelt. It was me, my sister, and a girlfriend of mine in the car. And by the grace of God, you know, or whatever, somehow we were all, you know, generally okay. And some gentleman came by, some truck driver, and you know, got rid of the Boone's Mill in the back seat and the pipe in the glove box. And so by the time the police came, we're all good. And I think my sister was probably the worst hurt, and she wanted to go to the hospital. And I was like, no hospital, because I was so scared of getting caught, you know. And so we went home, and I got out of that scot free, you know. No breathalyzer, no nothing. And so shortly after that, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by being tricked into a meeting by my sister. She was going to one, and she asked me to come to one with her just to hang out with her, just to spend time with her. It wasn't because I needed AA or anything. It was just to spend time with her. And so I went to this meeting, and the only reason I agreed to go to this meeting, I should say, is that two of the guys that picked her up for a meeting the previous night, one of them was extremely attractive. And I thought, okay, this AA meeting can't be that bad. So I went. And I was kind of, like, attacked at this meeting by people. They knew I was new, and they gave me a big book, and this woman told me she was going to sponsor me, and I had no idea what was happening. But I kind of came around AA for a couple months on and off, not real any really consistent sobriety. But I sat in some speaker meetings and some discussion meetings, and that's where the seed was planted for me. You know, I do remember relating to some people and things that they would share in these meetings. But for me, I was just at a place, I was 16 years old, and I felt like there was no way that AA is the only solution for me. You know, I just felt like I was smarter than that or something. You know, I was stronger than that. I could stop if I wanted to. I just don't want to. kind of thing. And I just really wasn't willing to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, you know. Life being unmanageable, that was kind of clear. That was kind of always clear. But the powerless part, I couldn't admit that. And I went back on my merry way. And over the next probably about 9 months or a year, I really hit my bottom very, very, very quickly. I got involved with a lot of shady people doing shady things, and I was just as shady as they were. I had dropped out of high school. At this point in my life, I already had assault charges, been banned from places, grand theft charges that my mother dropped, because I decided to steal her bank card when I was like 15 and go on a shopping spree, and just like things like that. Just I was that obnoxious kid that you couldn't get rid of, you know. And so I dropped out of school when I was 16. At this point, I wasn't going home very often. I would be away from home for maybe weeks at a time. And just to give you kind of a little idea of what a normal night was for me and how I was living my life, the night before I decided to go back into rehab, I was at a hotel with my best friend and her family, her stepdad and her mother and her little sister and some other people that were partying with us. And I had, I think, drank a bottle of Jack Daniels. I had done 5 pills of ecstasy. I had smoked some pot. I had shared 5 grams of coke with my friend's mom and a bag of crystal meth with my friend's little sister, who was like 13 years old, by the way, if this isn't bad enough. And there was a lot of other really horrible stuff going on. And I just remember, like every hour in the hour, I was throwing up, but I was still there. I was still awake. I was still conscious. And somewhere around 3, 4 in the morning, something like that, I remember sitting in this hotel room just feeling so absolutely disgusted with myself and so angry with myself and so angry with the world and the people I was with and everything. And I just remember thinking, like, I can't go on living like this. I just can't. You know, and but on the other side of it, I absolutely knew that when I woke up stone cold sober in the morning, that I couldn't live like that either. And the best way I found to describe how I feel or how I felt sober without a solution in Alcoholics Anonymous is I felt like I'd rather bang my head against a brick wall over and over again than feel that insanity that was inside of me when I was sober, you know. And It was like I was at the jumping off place, and that was my moment of divine intervention. And I went to a meeting the next night, and I didn't get to that meeting sober. I couldn't have gotten to that meeting sober. I don't remember a lot of it except for people were so welcoming to me. And I remember this group of women kind of surrounding me and, like, offering me help. And they were so nice, and they were so shiny, and I just hated them. I hated them. I mean, really, and I'm pretty sure I said some expletives to them about how I felt and how I felt about them approaching me and being nice. and because I just felt, you know, I suffer from terminal uniqueness. And I just think that there's no way that you could possibly understand who I am and what I am and where I come from. Because look at you and look at me. You're shiny, you're clean, you're smiling. How could you possibly understand what this feels like? You know, I couldn't see that miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous had worked in their lives, and that's why they seemed so different to me from myself. And I went into rehab, and how quickly our ego rebuilds itself, it's absolutely amazing. I had been, and I spent my, I was seven, I was turned 17 while I was in rehab. And, you know, the colorblind kid that was in rehab with me drew me a picture of my birthday, and we had juice cups, and it was wonderful. And, you know, I must have been in rehab 4 or 5 days when all of a sudden it was like, I don't need to be here. This is excessive. You know, it's like, these people need to be here, but I am good. You know, it was like, I've been to AA before. I had a sponsor. You know, I'm good. But the counselor disagreed with me and thought that I should stay. And, you know, I wasn't old enough to check myself out. I was 17. So being the horrific daughter that I was, I called my mom, and I said, you need to come pick me up. And she said, no, you're going to stay there. Good for her, right? And then I told her that if she didn't come pick me up, I'd either punch my roommate in the face to get arrested and she could pick me up from jail, or I would go AWOL and the police would find me and she could pick me up from jail again. And I told her it was her choice. So she came and she signed me out of rehab. And that poor woman. And, you know, I went home. And I really went home with good intentions. I mean, I wasn't going home to drink. That was not what I was leaving rehab for. I really thought, I got this, I'm good, I'm going to stay sober. And but when I got home, I said, I'm going to stay sober without AA. I don't need AA. And so, you know, I started going on walks every day, like a couple-mile walks. And while I was walking, I contemplate this, like how simple it is. Like, just don't drink. Just don't drink, you know, in my head. And just like these little things, like I can do this. I'm going to will myself into staying sober. And I'll be fine, and you know, and then desire and opportunity crossed, and I got drunk again, and then I tried to commit suicide because I just didn't know what other way, you know. And I say that, I don't know if I was really trying to commit suicide. You know, what happened was my mom said something that upset me, probably something that had to do with the truth about my life, and my response to her was swallowing a bottle of pills in front of her and then locking myself in my bedroom. That was what I did. And a few hours later, she got me out and she took me to the emergency room. Luckily, my tolerance was so high that they didn't even have to pump my stomach. So we were good. And I assured the nice nurse that I was not trying to kill myself because I knew I did not want to go to the psych ward. And they let me go. And I went back to a meeting after that. And that was December of 2001. And I went back to a meeting, and I got a sponsor again, and I started working the steps. And I was going to a meeting every single day, and I started getting involved in service. I would pick people up for the meeting. I would help set up the meeting or clean up the meeting or make coffee or pick up cigarette butts, or we still smoked in one of our meetings then. I cleaned the ashtrays or whatever. And I was kind of doing this, you know, but the part that I struggled with the most was that honesty part, you know. I could have cash register honesty. I could tell my sponsor whether or not I had stolen something that day. I could tell my sponsor whether or not I bold-faced lied to somebody. But I lied by omission on a regular basis. I could not be honest with you about my thoughts, because if I told you my thoughts, you were going to tell me I needed to change them. And I didn't want to change them. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, you know. And I was still in touch with a lot of my old drinking buddies, which I can assure you were not normal drinkers that were just, like, nice people. And, you know, I just started kind of living this double life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd pick up a couple people for the meeting, go set up, make coffee, hang out, go to the diner. And then I'd go home, or I'd get in my car, make a phone call, I'd go home, and I'd hang out with all my old friends, you know. And things slowly got better. And then September of that year, I was still not being so honest about my thoughts and my actions. You know, like I said, I thought that if I told my sponsor what my plans were, she was going to tell me I needed to change my plans. And she didn't know what was best for me as far as I was concerned, and that I was just fine. And what happened for me was desire and opportunity crossed again. And it talks about it, and there is a solution perfectly. It says, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, that we are without defense against the first drink. And that is exactly what happened to me. I was at my house. I was in community college now at this point. I got my GD and I had gone back to school, and I was working on a project with some people from class, and we were at like a restaurant bar place, and a couple people ordered drinks. They asked me if it bothered me. I was like, no, go ahead, you're fine, whatever. Mind you, I'm like 9 months sober at this point. I had no business being there. But and everything was fine, and I left, and I came home, and everything was fine, and there was a party going on down the street at one of my old friends' houses, and a few guys stopped by, say hello, hey, how are you? I stood in my driveway with them while they're getting high, chatted for a minute. And that's when that switch just started to flip. Why can't I drink? That's such a silly thought, to be powerless over alcohol. Like, it's just a liquid. There's nothing wrong with drinking it. I was just in a bad place. That's all it was. I could probably drink normally. I bet nothing would happen if I took a drink. And those people left, and then some other friends stopped by. And they said, hey, you just want to go riding around, hang out? And I said, sure, let's do that. And they were drinking a couple 40s. And I said, let me get a sip of that 40. Just like that. That was it. There was no other thought that came into my mind. There was no fear. It was just, let me get a sip of that 40. And after I drank his 40, I said, who wants to go to the city? You know, and that's what we did. And, we got back to my house, and I was too drunk to walk up the steps to my front door. And my friend helped me up and carried me in the house. And nothing horrific happened that night. Nothing horrific happened that night. But when I woke up that next morning, I knew that there was no possible way in this world that I could get sober again. One night of drinking, and that obsession was back full force. There was no possible way. And it was just the efforts. You know, I mean, that's all I can say. It was like, you know what? Screw life. It'll be what it'll be. You know, and luckily for me, I had a couple friends in AA who called me and felt otherwise about my decisions and convinced me to come back to a meeting. And I don't know if those two people should have called me or not. I don't know if that was like sponsor suggested, but they did. And it was enough to convince me to come back to a meeting. You know, God intervened for me in my life once again. And I went to that meeting and I went feeling awful. I felt absolutely awful. And I'm standing outside in front of the meeting, and this woman came up to me who I had known well, and she said, what's going on, Lisa? How are you? And I said, I'm awful. I drank. And she said, well, that's okay. You're an alcoholic. That's what we do. Welcome. And it was just like, okay, I can be here and pick up yet another 24-hour chip. And I was not happy about it, but it was like, okay, I am welcome here. This is where I belong. And it was not easy. I mean, those first few months, I prayed a lot, like chanting, praying in my car, like on my way home, because my car did not want to go home, you know, and it was just serenity prayer over and over and over again. Help me, God, over and over and over again. If I could call someone, I would. Sometimes it was late, and it was just prayer, 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 you know, and do the best that you can. And I kind of had a new willingness and a new desire this time around. You know, it was yet again, it was proved to me that I can't drink normally. You know, that I truly am powerless over alcohol, even though nothing horrific happened that night. It was the way I felt that next morning when I woke up that defined for me my alcoholism. You know, that obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. It was supposed to be a sip of a 40, not a whole 40, and then other fun activities. Or not so fun active, I mean, whichever way you're going to look at it. You know, and it was like, clearly, I had that allergy of the body. I thought in my head before I took that drink, I'm going to drink normally. This is going to be a normal night, and I was proved wrong yet again. And waking up in the morning feeling that that insanity on me, it really made it clear for me my powerlessness over alcohol. And I got my sponsor back again, and we started going through the steps again. And I was a lot more honest this time around. You know, that newfound motivation, that willingness, you know, to not want to experience that pain yet again, that disappointment, you know. I was not the type of person that just drank and passed out. You know, I drank and did shit, you know. I would wake up in the morning, I wouldn't know where my car was, or I wouldn't know where my car was, and it was in the front yard, and it wasn't supposed to be in the front yard, you know, it's supposed to be on the street. It's usually how you park a car. And, you know, I'd wake up next to people that, you know, they had clothes on, I didn't. I wasn't really sure what happened, had no recollection of the night before, you know. These things happened on a daily basis for me, you know. It wasn't like if I drank again that it was just going to be like, oh, I'm going to feel like crap in the morning. It was like if I drink again, I am literally going to destroy my life. Like, I can't live like this anymore. And so with my sponsor, we started going through the steps, and I stayed involved in service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was taught very early on in AA that if someone asks you to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, you say yes. If you can physically do it, you say yes. And it's not service if it's not inconvenient. That's what I was told. Although now I feel like service, I enjoy it. It's not inconvenient anymore, you know. And, I mean, there were nights where I would drive around the entire beltway, you know, of D.C., driving people home to, like, Springfield. I lived in, like, Baltimore and, you know, whatever. And I ended up, the situation I was living in when I got sober was not ideal. I was living with my mother, and as awful as I was to her, she was a very sick woman, and it was a very unhealthy atmosphere for me, and I finally moved out of there, and I lived with my dad for a few months, which was a really amazing experience, by the way, him and my stepmother. And, you know, I remember I moved in with them November of 2002, I believe it was. And, you know, it was the first time in my life that I really celebrated Christmas. You know, since, you know, growing up, like, in my mom's house, it was like we were always just, you know, between my mom's mental illness and my sister and I drinking, like, Christmas didn't really happen in our house. I mean, like, if the Christmas tree went up, it was because I put it up. If presents got wrapped, it's because we wrapped them. You know, it wasn't like, it just felt like a very sad life, a very sad life. And living with my dad that first Christmas sober was just such a cool experience for me because I had never given him a chance to be a part of my life or my stepmother for that matter. I mean, when I was drinking when they got married and I got kicked out of their wedding because I wouldn't show up for one of my dress fittings, you know. I was supposed to be a bridesmaid. So living with them was amazing, and I got to help decorate for Christmas with my stepmother. And I just remember it really being having a huge impact on me in my life and in my sobriety. It was kind of that first chance for me to learn about what living amends were and trying to be a different human being. And I only lived with them for a few months, and then I had had enough. And and I moved in with five other sober girls in a house, which I don't know if that was much better. And that was interesting, too, you know. And I moved in there. I was, you know, 18 years old, and I thought I knew everything. And I just really was so self-centered. And I remember, like, not coming home one night, and I was with sober people. But the next day, my roommate was really upset at me. And I was like, what's the deal, dude? Like, why are you so angry? I don't understand what your problem is. And she was like, Lisa, we care about you. Like, we love you, and we want to know you're safe. And I was like, oh, my God, really? Like, it was like a revelation to me. Like, oh, my gosh, these people, like, accountability, what is that? You know, I just felt like, get out of my business, woman. You know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But when she sat down and explained this to me, you know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me how to live. I didn't understand what accountability meant. I didn't understand what it meant to be kind to others and what a caring, healthy relationship looked like. You know, and she explained it to me. And she taught me about how to be a roommate. And she wasn't always her roommate either. But she certainly knew a lot more about it than I did. And that was a wonderful experience for me, living with these five girls. There were crazy nights and good nights, but it was a wonderful way to get sober. And, you know, I remember around this time, I was probably about 9 months sober when my boyfriend and I decided we were going to move in together. And we went and looked at the apartment, and I think we even signed the lease. And then, like, a week later, we were at this young people's conference, and I found out I was pregnant. And I was like, not the plan, you know, but here we were, sober, and, you know, and I was like, it was a really difficult thing for me, and that's where I feel like 6 and 7 really started playing a big part in my life, like, character building over comfort seeking. And for me, I was 18 years old. I did not have a good reputation from coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and all of my craziness. And a lot of people said things to me, even in AA, a lot of people said things to me like, you are really selfish if you have this child. People said things to me like, you need to get an abortion. People told me, you absolutely need to give this child up for adoption. But my sponsor had taught me how to inventory, and my sponsor had taught me a little bit about these steps. And it taught me about prayer and meditation and about that really important thing that's on the back of our chips that says, to thine own self be true. And it was not an easy process for me at a year sober and 18 years old. But I did what I felt was right with me and God, and I decided to have that baby. And I was pregnant at my one-year anniversary, and I had my almost fiancé there to support me every step of the way. And I had my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who I knew I could count on, and my sponsor. And my sponsor worked with me thoroughly, thoroughly during this time. And I had my little girl, who is now 10 years old, by the way. And she was wonderful, and it was difficult. And my then-fiancé and I at the time moved back in with my mom for a little while to try and save money and figure things out and get our jobs and our lives together. And I dropped out of school and got a full-time job. And it was really, really, really freaking hard. I remember those first few months living out near Baltimore, and all the meetings I went to were out in D.C., and I was at home on maternity leave, and I was losing my ever-loving mind. I was convinced that the world hated me. I was convinced that everybody from my home group hated me. I was convinced that there was nowhere I could turn. And all of it was my alcoholism just attacking me full force. And thank God I had an amazing sponsor who taught me, and all the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, who taught me that I have to go against myself, that if I feel like I need to be at home, then that means I need to get my butt to a meeting. If I feel like I don't want to call anybody, that means I need to call people. And I would just reach out to these people despite how I felt, because I knew I had no other choice. And people would come out to Baltimore and visit me after work, sit like 3 hours in traffic, and bring me dinner, and just bring me meetings, and just hang out with me and keep me company until I could get out of that situation. And we moved out on our own, and I ended up getting my sponsor ended up asking me to get a new sponsor. She told me that she didn't feel like she was helping me, and that she felt like I needed to find somebody else to sponsor me. And that was really hard for me, because when I was coming in and out of AA, I sponsor hopped a lot, but this woman, I really liked this woman, you know, and I didn't want to get a new sponsor. And I told her, I was like, I'm just going to talk to you until I find someone else. Is that okay? She was like, yeah, that's fine. But like, I didn't get anybody. I just kept talking to her, you know, and she was like, no, you need to get a new sponsor. And so I did, and that was a really hard thing for me as well. You know, it takes me a while to get to know people, get in the groove, you know, a sponsor relationship, that's always a little like, you got to get into this and figure out what do you want from me, what are the expectations. And it just seemed really difficult, but I got this woman, and I just kind of had to surrender to the idea that this is what it was going to be. And that woman has been my sponsor since, and oh my gosh, I love her so much. And she started walking me through the steps yet again. And at this point, I had been kind of stagnant. My previous sponsor wouldn't do the eighth step with me. And so at this point in my sobriety, I had never gone through the eighth step or on. And so I got this new sponsor, and we started going through the steps again. And it was a brand new experience for me this time around. I had been a couple years sober at this point, but for me it felt like I was doing this stuff for the first time ever. And I don't know if it was just I could hear her more clearly, or my brain, the fog had settled a little bit, so I could see more clearly my own defects. But I know that when I went through the fourth and fifth step with her, that was a painful experience for me. The fourth step, anyway, writing the fourth step was a painful experience for me, because it was the first time in my life that I wasn't just looking at the wrongs I had done when I was drinking, but the wrongs that I had done those first couple years of sobriety, stone cold sober, how I was harming people, you know, how insensitive I was to other people, like purposely purposely hurting others for my own benefit. You know, that's when those defects really started to shine for me. And doing that fifth step with her was a great, you know, it was the first time I felt like those fifth step promises come true, or it's like rocketed into a new dimension of living. And we went on, and, you know, I stayed stagnant again, Alcoholics Anonymous, for a long time. I really didn't do much else as far as, like, six, seven, eight, nine. You know, I would do, like, morning readings, and I would do daily inventories and stuff, but I really didn't do anything else, and I just went along my way. I was doing plenty of service work. I was sponsoring people here and there, and, you know, and just kind of life took its course for me, you know, and what happened for me was I really feel like I spent years in AA just being blindly led by my defects of character. And I'm so grateful that it wasn't worse than what it was. But coming out of that sucked big time, you know. And my sponsor had been going through a rough time, and she had had a lot of stuff going on herself in her personal life. And she had kind of this newfound motivation and dedication to AA in her life, which was so beneficial for me. And we started going through the book again together every week as a group with all of our sponsors and anybody, or all of her sponsees and anybody else that wanted to come. We gathered at her house and we started going through the book again, and we started going through the steps again. And it has been an absolutely amazing experience for me. At this point in time, I mean, my sobriety, the outside circumstances in my life have been up and down. You know, I got married in sobriety. My husband's here. He's amazing, and I love him so much. And we had all of the members of our bridal party, the wedding party at the time, were sober, friends, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was great. You know, we've had our ups and downs. We've had times where we've been so freaking broke that we've, you know, we couldn't buy groceries, and there have been other times where we weren't broke, but we forgot to pay the electric bill, and it got shut off, you know? I mean, it's just been the ups and downs of learning, you know, we're still unmanageable, right? And, you know, but what happened for me when we started going through the steps again this time with my sponsor, I was really at a difficult point in my life and in my sobriety. My husband had been laid off, and we had bought this house right before the economy drops, and you know, so after like a month after buying our house, it was worth half of what we paid for it. And then my husband had lost his job for a little while, and you know, instead of just moving and walking away, I mean, we didn't know it was best at the time. We had no idea. And you know, we tried to keep our house, and in trying to keep our house, we emptied out our savings, our 401ks, our pension, everything. And in the end, we still didn't get to keep the house, you know, and not to mention, you know, poor behavior on top of being broke and about to lose the house, and trying to raise these children. And I had had three miscarriages before I got pregnant with my son, and the pregnancy with my son was extremely difficult. I had some medical issues, and my husband had medical issues, and there was just all, it just seemed like pure insanity everywhere. I hated my job. It was miserable. But I couldn't do anything about it. And it was just like all these circumstances of life just ruling me, absolutely ruling me. And I just become like a victim of circumstance, which is a horrible place to be in. Because if you're a victim, you can't do anything about it. It just sucks. And I had just gotten to a place where I was so unhappy and just felt so wronged in my life. And I remember going to these weekly meetings with my sponsor, and we were like, I'm doing the fourth step again. And we're reading the promises, and she had just done her fifth step again, and she's promising me that I'm going to get these promises. And I remember being in the car one day on the way home, just so filled with anxiety, so resentful, so irritated. And I remember driving home just thinking, a drink would fix this. And that was the first time I had had that thought, really, in the course of my sobriety. And I remember calling her, and I remember yelling to her, not at her, but to her, like, Beth, you know what? Fine. I'll do this four step. I'll do it. But you better not be lying to me that I'm going to get these promises, you know? Because I was like, I can't live like this anymore. And so she was like, Lisa, I promise you, you do it, you're going to get the promises. I was like, okay, fine, you know, and this is kind of how what she was working with at the moment. And you know, I did, you know, we did that fifth step, and things started getting better, you know, and there is a new a new level of the third step in my life, really, a new level of surrender that I hadn't had in a long time. I mean, people were throwing options at me and solutions at me, but I didn't want any of those options or solutions, you know. But finally, in the process of starting to go through these steps again and then going through 6 and 7, starting to work on my 8th step, it was like, okay, you know, what else do I have to lose? Like, whatever you want from me, God, wherever you want me to be, whatever you want me to be, like, here I am, you know, and that new level of surrender, throwing in that towel and just saying, I don't know what's best for me because I can't handle it anymore. It was too much, and I had to give it up to God. And so we made a decision. We moved in with my parents for a year while we were trying to decide where we were going to move, because clearly we couldn't afford to live in the D.C. area anymore. And that was an experience in itself. Talk about cheerfully capitalized as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. Oh, my gosh. Hated it, right? Because it sucked. I mean, my father, I love him. He's a wonderful man. But his ideas of parenting and mine are extremely different. And, you know, he would scream at my children. And it was just like, and they were so picky people. And it was, and I had to be nice, right? I'm going through these steps. I'm working with my sponsor. I have to be nice. I have to be principled. I can't fight this. And it was... It was a very strenuous year for me, but I will tell you what, I mean, I came out of that with a, not only having a wonderful relationship with them and being able to make my amends, but also growing so much as a person. I mean, I learned so much how to stand up for myself in a principled way during that time. I learned how to communicate in a kind way. You know, I learned how to detach. I learned how to love. I mean, it was just like a new ideas all over the place for me of what it meant to have those kind of personal relationships. And it was hard. I mean, there were nights where I was calling my sponsor screaming, crying, like, I don't want my children. So dramatic, right? I don't want my children to grow up like I did, you know, and all of this craziness. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, this chapter, got me through it. And I was able to grow, you know, and we made the decision to move here, or not here, to Smith Mountain Lake, Virginia, where my in-laws lived. And I was really scared to move. You know, I'm a really social person. I would hang out with my girlfriends on a regular basis up in Maryland. I mean, on my lunch break, I'd go over and hang out with them. And I mean, it was just like a daily occurrence. And I was really scared to move to Smith Mountain Lake. It's a very quiet, very rural town, a lot of retirement. Not a lot of people like me. And I was very scared. And they don't have a lot of jobs down there, especially well-paying jobs, and I was really nervous about that. And I remember I had a couple job interviews, and I'm just feeling awful about myself. The job interviews that I have, I don't want the job, but I have to do my best on the interview because it's the principled thing to do. And, you know, like, just really struggling. And I remember just being so upset about the whole thing. And I just remember crying and getting down on my knees and praying to God, like, God, whatever you want for me, fine. Like, whatever you want for me. And then my phone rang 20 minutes later. And it was someone asking me if I could come in for an interview for a job I didn't even apply for. And I was like, sure. Okay, thanks, God. We're cool now, you know, like 100 back down to zero, one phone call. And, you know, and I just had to keep trying to surrender and trust in God and that it was all going to be okay. And I got down there, and I can't even tell you. God has such better plans for me than I've ever had for myself. My dream was always to work with kids in some way, especially disadvantaged kids and teenagers and stuff like that. And that's always what I've wanted to do, but I never was in a position where I could go back to school and get a degree or anything like that. And so when I got down here, when I got down to Southern Virginia, I just took a few part-time jobs so I could try and be with my kids more of the time and then and work as needed to pay the bills. And what happened was one of my part-time jobs, I was just doing some database stuff and website stuff part-time and for a nonprofit that works with disadvantaged children. And the program director they had hired decided to leave, that it wasn't the job for her. And as a result of carrying these principles into all my affairs and doing above and beyond what I was asked to do in my work, I was offered the position of program director. And that's what I've been doing for almost a year, and it has been awesome. I work from home, so I'm with my kids. You know, I make enough money to pay my bills, and it's fantastic, and I do what I love. You know, and I spent 10 years working in a law firm hating my life. And so to go from that to this, it's like God really does have better plans for me than I could ever have for myself. Not only do I get to spend more time with my family, but I get to do what I love for a living. And, you know, kind of like the other God moment for me in the past couple of years was I kept seeing in my church bulletin that they were looking for a youth group minister. And the first time I saw it, I was like, you know, And then I saw it again, and I was like, you know. Then I saw it again, like, 3 months later, and I was like, And I didn't say anything to anyone. And my mother-in-law caught me in the kitchen one day, and she said, did you see that they're looking for a youth group minister? And I was like, yeah, I saw, you know. And I said, you know, I thought about it. I would love it because I love working with teenagers. I said, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm adequate for the position, you know. And for me, it was like it's amazing to me how many old ideas I can still find out I carry with me in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it was a position at church. And for some reason, deep down inside, I felt like I wasn't good enough to work at church. You know, I don't know what that is. But that's how I felt, honestly. I just felt like, look at me, look at my story, you know, what kind of example am I, you know, is how but the real deal is I do live a principled life for the most part today, and I am a caring person as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, but I just felt so inadequate. But my mother-in-law said, just call and ask her about it. So I said, okay, I'll call and ask her about it. So I called this woman at church and asked her about it, and she said, come in Thursday for an interview. And I was like, what? You know, and she was like, come in Thursday for an interview. So I said, okay. So I went into this interview, and I'm still scared. And at this point, I kind of don't want the job anymore, right? Because I'm, like, really nervous, and I'm just feeling like this is not for me. But I pray, and I'm like, all right, God, help me do the best that I can do and just speak through me and whatever. So I go in this interview, and they start it with a prayer. And they started asking me questions about my personal life. And I'm very generalized with my answers, you know, like, well, what brought you back to church? And what brought, you know, I'm very general. And the deacon just finally got irritated with my general answers. He goes, I want to know about your life. He goes, you tell me about. So I told him my story. And I had the woman from the board in there crying her eyes out. She started sharing her story with me. And you know, we just had this, like, love fest about our life. And we ended with a prayer, and I left, and I thought, well, that was weird. And she called me, and she asked me if I would take the job, and I did. And I took that job about a year ago, and it is just, I still feel inadequate, I'll be honest. But I do it anyway, you know, because that's what God has put in front of me. And for me, it's just like, and I've been so blessed to be able to sponsor someone, have a dear friend down Smith Mountain Lake, Mary, who's here with me tonight, and she's been wonderful, and we're holding each other accountable right now, and it's just been such a blessing. I mean, I just have so much good in my life as the result of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and as a result of these steps and making amends and, you know, daily prayer, I mean, is so important in my life. But, you know, I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, I am not the same person today that I was even 5 years ago, let alone almost 12 years ago. There has been a rearrangement in my thoughts. There has been a change in me. Don't get me wrong, I'm still alcoholic. We were out to dinner the other night, and my neighbor ordered a mudslide, and I was like, damn, that looks good. You know, the alcoholic is still there, but I have a daily reprieve today. You know, the obsession has been removed. And as long as I keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as I keep saying yes, I keep praying, and I keep trying to go through these steps with my sponsor and be honest and open and willing. I have a chance today. I have a chance for my life to be more beautiful than I ever could have possibly imagined for myself. So I'm so grateful to be here and for my sobriety, and thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.